So Shadi, you're up next, and then Nap. So just, that's my concern. Go ahead.
Okay, two questions. First, I was struck by the quote from, I believe it was Paul Nelson, where he said something like, he has a bag of intuitions, but not necessarily the data or research. That struck me as a little bit concerning because it sounds like he's already reached the conclusion and then needs to find a way to fill the gap and find research or data that leads him to where his intuition suggests he should go. Let's say hypothetically he stumbled upon research or data that led him against his intuition. Could he, as a committed evangelical from his particular perspective, accept that data? That's one. And then just a question on, you said something about evangelicals not wanting, something about a hand grenade. What was the exact?
Oh, I think David was saying, am I creating confusion by giving them options along a continuum?
Yeah. So it strikes me sometimes when I hear about evangelical movements that there's almost this persistent concern that if they go out too much into mainstream institutions, that their faith may not be sufficiently resilient. And but it would seem to me that if they found the capital T truth and there's real conviction, then there should be a kind of confidence that goes along with it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just thinking about, you know, other religious movements that really make it a thing to infiltrate, if you will, mainstream institutions. I'm thinking, for example, about the Gulen movement in Turkey, and others that don't seem to be afraid to be co-opted or absorbed by mainstream institutions and feel that's necessary to achieve their objectives.
Well, Christian Smith, by the way, has written a lot about cognitive contamination. Am I right, Chris? You did, yes. So after Jeff is formulating his question, I may turn to you and say, tell us what that means.
Shadi, this is terrible. I forgot the first part of your question already. I'm brain dead. Oh, yes. Yeah. So actually, I quoted Paul a second time, and he said, look, the overwhelming evidence argues against a young earth, nevertheless he holds that position. So that seems to be an answer in a way that it's not evident that there would be a sufficient weight of information that would change his mind. So I'm not sure that he's epistemically open to other possibilities. Now I'd have to talk to Paul about this. Would he really be open? I mean, what he usually says is, the Bible just seems to say this is how it was. I must believe that. And so that's just really how it is. So then what's the point of finding data? That's a great question, right? So the point of finding data, first of all, let's talk about what would data look like for intelligent design people. I think most of us in the scientific community find the arguments look sort of like the following. We don't understand how process X works. Therefore, that's evidence that God must have stepped in and bridged the gap because we don't have an understanding of that. Now, intelligent design theorists want to say more than that. They want to say there will never be a scientific explanation, therefore God must bridge that gap. But that's not so clear. So there's a very famous example of Isaac Newton in his Principia. He said, you know, I can't fully account for the orbits of all the planets. The data looks really good, except there's just a few wobbles in the orbits of these planets I can't explain. Well, he didn't know about the outer planets. They hadn't been discovered yet, and they have a gravitational effect on the inner planets. But his solution was God must reset the orbits of the planets when they decay so that the planets can continue in their orbits. And so there was a gap he couldn't explain, and he invoked God to explain the inexplicable there. Now, later, of course, Neptune and Uranus were discovered, and that explained Newton's data. Newtonian mechanics explains the orbits of the planets. He just didn't have all the information. So if you look at an example like that, scientists like me tend to be very hesitant to want to say we're not going to be able to figure that out one day. We're quite comfortable saying we have no idea how that works. You know, gravity is a good example. We do not have a coherent explanation of gravity that takes into account the very small and the very fast. So this is the realm of quantum mechanics. We can't take that part of physics and unite it with the really big uber stuff that happens in the universe that relates to what Einstein called general relativity. We don't have a theory that knits those together yet. Do we deny the existence of gravity? I think not. I think we admit gravity works. But we don't have a coherent theory of gravity. But in that case, most Christians do not step in and want to explain the lack of a theory using God talk. That's interesting to me. Why do we not do that there, but we do want to do it with biological evolution? I think the difference is that the uniqueness of humans and our origins through biological processes is in play in the latter case and not in physics. So there's a difference there of why we want to jump to that conclusion. The ID people, I think, ultimately hope that by showing gaps in our understanding and the need for an intelligent designer, that people will be brought to a sense that they need to seek that intelligent designer.
And on the question of... Chris, you want to quickly say something about Shadi's point about... I mean, he's written a whole book on this, cognitive contamination.
In short, evangelicalism thrives in part because of the embattled sense that it feels and constructs in relation to threats from the world. That's part of its energy. It does a lot, and I have a whole theory about how this works. At the same time, I would say sociologically, to keep all this in perspective, pretty much every human social group has orthodoxies, senses of purity and danger, and is happy to conduct any versions of their own versions of inquisitions or exclusions or even though evangelicals are sort of way obvious on this and worry about contamination, in some sense it's just part of human nature and social life to be worried about boundaries and the other and contamination and so on. And sometimes I think we privilege some groups as being really strange about that without realizing that's just kind of general human operational procedure.
So I do briefly want to answer the last part of Shadi's question, which is why, if evangelicals feel like they have the truth with a capital T, why aren't they out there proclaiming that truth and mixing it up, and why are they afraid of this contamination issue? I mean, that's a really good question. There have been times in the past where they have really mixed it up. I mean, you know, evangelicals were very famously involved in the abolition of the slave trade in England, for example. William Wilberforce has a really... probably way oversighted example, but I think a good one. There have been times when, you know, in the U.S., it's often been co-opted by expressions of, like, the religious right and the moral majority, for example, that was an example. That's not really evangelical per se, although there were a lot of evangelicals involved. But there are lots of evangelicals who I think are actually out there mixing it up. You just maybe don't know that they are like this. You know, Francis Collins is a good example. There are people in lots of areas of life. I think there are some people in this room. I mean, I know this is not something you guys really like to do, but if we took a poll of your personal religious beliefs, we'd get a pretty interesting statement about people being out in the culture. The question is whether they are proclaiming their faith in the midst of performing their job, and that's something maybe they're not doing all the time. But it might be a mistake to assume that all evangelicals are scared of being out in the culture and interacting with the world. I think that would be a mistake. There is certainly an impulse towards separation among some evangelicals, but a lot of evangelicals have a strong sense of a cultural mandate to go out there and try to be a redeeming or a leavening influence in the culture.
Quickly on this, David, and then...
I think it is important to consider the broader implications of what Sarah was asking in part, whether it relates to sexuality or other areas of skepticism, because, Jeff, what I hear you saying is that there is a threshold test for truth which competes with the truth with a capital T. And in your realm, you think there's been something that's approached that, and therefore it should become more central, even for evangelicals, to allow this this competing information. But when you said earlier, you talked about you can look at the creation story and look at God breathing the spirit into Adam and see, well, that doesn't say specifically how he created life. It invites skepticism. Aren't the implications of your work and your beliefs such that there should be broader skepticism, even for evangelicals, in other areas of understanding the Bible, perhaps with regard to sexuality, homosexuality, or other areas? Should it not have broader implications?
I mean, I just don't see it as skepticism. I'm not sure I want to triangulate the discussion along those lines. I guess I would, as I think about it for myself, I would prefer the phrase self-critical. Skepticism implies something different to me. I want to be a self-critical reader of the scriptures. Anyone who has studied church history will quickly recognize the historical contextualization of a lot of Christian thought. It's pretty much impossible for us to fully extricate ourselves from our historical embeddedness. And to pretend that we can do so is arrogant. So I don't want to be like that. I'm arrogant sometimes. Anyone who knows me will, my wife will tell you that. But I think, so I think that's what I'm trying to say. Maybe I didn't say it well, that I want to be sure that my approach to the scriptures is not, to the extent that I can make it possible, I don't want to bring inappropriate baggage to my interpretation of scripture. And the different kinds of baggage that have been brought to the scriptures have differed over the history of the church over two millennia. And we can look back with hindsight and say, those guys, boy, they really didn't have it. But I really want to be careful about that. St. Augustine has a really great quote, which I can reproduce it, but I won't tire you with it. But basically he says, look, I don't want, and this is in his commentary on the book of Genesis, it's called the literal meaning of Genesis, but for him, literal had a very different meaning from how we would use the word literal. But the point he makes there is, look, my interpretation of Genesis, if there's some really knowledgeable person next door here who, I don't want to say something really foolish here. I want to say, because that is really going to discredit the church. So that's, I'm much more concerned about that than about, I just don't have a goal of inciting widespread skepticism. I believe that the scriptures are just crucial for faith and life, as evangelicals like to say. And So I hope you haven't misheard me on that particular point. I know this is true for me, so I don't know. You can weigh this for yourself if you've ever tried to read something, but I think we all bring our own ideologies to the table. So we want certain things to be true. We talked about Paul Nelson, but it's not restricted to creation and evolution. We bring things to the scriptures that we want to be true, and so we're strongly tempted to find them there. And I just want to be careful to avoid doing that whenever I can. I want to be, just as I'm an empiricist about the natural world, I want to try to be, to the extent that I can, an empiricist about the scriptures.
Okay, we're coming down close to the end, and we've got three people. We've got Knapp and Mike Gerson and Matt Lewis. And I'd love to get all three of you in before we rush out and grab our box lunches and go to lunch. So if you could be concise, and let's try to get it done before noon. Knapp, pull the microphone over and turn it on.
All right, I'll try to make this short. So the back to the public school debate. So yeah, I'm sorry. You expressed uncertainty, so I'm sorry to bring it back to you. But I think there would be general consensus that parents want their kids taught what the debate is about, right? And yeah. I think most parents would not be offended to have their children presented the information that you presented, right?
I think that's right.
And so we'd probably have this broad consensus, but then when you get to the question of, well, which class will it be taught in, all of a sudden it's very passionate, taking sides, biology class versus civics class, which means, you know, the football coach teaching there.
Right.
So, and there's almost a sense of if it's taught in the biology class, then the biology will be corrupted by this information or something like that. So yeah. I wonder what you think about, you know, when you get down to the debate about which, you know, where that information should be taught.
Okay,
it doesn't matter.
Before you answer that, Jeff, I want to get Mike Gerson's question and Matt, and then you can answer all three together if you don't mind. Mike Gerson.
Okay, I hope I can make this brief. When I've written about this before, the reaction I've gotten is interesting. So David Klinghoffer, who accused me of writing my last column while I was sleepwalking, which was probably actually true, but said, to think that no assertion from science can challenge religion is to make your faith basically fatuous. If it is so forgiving, so content-free as to accommodate any statement whatsoever about the universe, about reality, valid or invalid, so long as the statement comes from scientists, I don't see that that is a formula for religion that's worthy of consideration. Now, he applies that to Darwinism as a guy at the Discovery Institute. But I'm just curious about, is there any conclusion of science that you could have imagine that would actually refute your faith? Is it possible for science, or is it an entirely different realm, is the issue that he's raising here? He uses the example of Maimonides, who said that he could not accept an eternal universe, okay, within the Jewish construct of thought, right? And we at some point have had a consensus about an essentially eternal universe, which we don't have now. I think that's true. But I'm just curious about whether there's any conclusion here that would essentially say, I can't accept that because of my faith tradition.
Okay, Matt, yours is going to be...
I'll pass.
Oh, God bless you.
He's got a lot to chew on.
Yes, he does. Thank you, Matt. That's almost heroic.
So let's go to Nap first, I guess. Right. I think this is really hard. I mean, I'll tell you what I do. So I don't teach evolutionary biology. I teach embryonic development. There, I teach a little bit about bioethics. And I flag it. I say, okay, now we've talked about the biology. Now let's talk about things the biology can't address. What is the value of human organisms? What is the nature of what it means to be essentially human, and when does that arise during a human organism's development, all of those kinds of things. So biology is an input into that discussion. So you don't want to say things that are silly, you know, like human organisms don't arise through fairy godmothers zapping women so that they become pregnant with fully formed human organisms in their womb. You know, it doesn't work that way. So that biology informs the question, but the question itself is a meta-scientific question. It involves your philosophy. It involves potentially your religious inputs. It certainly involves your metaphysical perspectives, right? So we can have that discussion in my biology classroom, I think, successfully, but they know we're not talking about biology. So I don't do a lot of that. It's a biology course, so it would be unfair to the students to do too much of that. But, I've been comfortable with doing a little bit of that, but we're not doing biology when we're doing that. I just want to be clear about that. We're not doing biology. So I think I would prefer to have those kinds of discussions in a way that flags it, wherever course it is, it flags it as we're not doing science anymore. We're talking about the implications or the questions raised by a scientific question. But thinking about them requires not doing, we need to think about other things that lie outside of science. Science can't answer some of those questions. So that's what I would like to see that happen. I think that's pretty rare. I don't know about the football coach. I've met some pretty smart football coaches in my time. So. Okay, so Michael's question about would there ever be a scientific discovery that would destroy my faith? I think people of faith have, you know, when you believe something, and it, I think if there's not a possibility of revision, then you have your faith is kind of held. It's kind of unassailable, I think, in some ways. I wouldn't say that I hold my faith in that way, but I am committed to certain key fundamental truths about Christianity. The Nicene Creed, which I mentioned, I'm good with everything that's in that statement, and I would go to the stake for all that stuff, you know. So I'm serious. So I'm really serious about it.
What, Chris?
If there was definitive proof that Jesus Christ wasn't raised from the dead, but was Roman soldiers were brought,
if there were definitive proof that Jesus, there were some fully naturalistic explanation for Jesus' resurrection,
or there was no resurrection.
Yes.
I tend to, by the way, view them as entirely separate. I can't imagine what that would be. I don't know what it would be, although there are cosmology issues that, you know, would it affect your views if they could prove a multiverse? Would it affect their view, you know, would there be any way for that to happen?
In 2 minutes, see what you can say.
I mean, I do view them as largely separate realms of inquiry. I do affirm that a single reality underlies both realms of inquiry. In part, your question is an epistemological one. Can they intersect in ways we would all agree, aha, that's a deal breaker from the science side? So I think David Klinghoffer, I don't know him at all, but I think clearly he thinks, yes, there will be such things one day. So I think that's a motivation for some intelligent design proponents, is that they want to find those spaces that provide the clear positive epistemic support for theism. I would rather go for a looking at the totality of reality and going for an inference to the best explanation. And for me, that's Christian theism. So that's not exactly the clean answer that you want, but I think that's how I view science. You know, thus far there hasn't been a scientific discovery in my lifetime anyway, and there have been a lot that have caused me any substantive faith issues. So I'm not like Jeremy O'Connell, who came to my office. I actually didn't go through a crisis of faith due to science.
Conveyor belts,
yeah. No, not conveyor belts, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, let it never be said we do not deal with late issues at the Faith Angle Forum. Before we thank Jeff, I want to be sure when you leave, be sure to thank Emily and Sylvia. These conferences would not happen without their wonderful assistance. So and also, join me in thanking Jeff for a wonderful presentation. We are very grateful. We're done. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being here.